Today, we have a special guest, Aaron Sconard, founder, president, and CEO of Pluralsight. And Pluralsight is a very interesting company, which you're going to hear a lot from very soon from Aaron. But let me tell you how we got connected and how I got to know the story and got interested in the story. So as you know, the whole Entrepreneur Journey series is based on our conversations with entrepreneurs who have succeeded up to a certain point. So Aaron was introduced to me in that context, and I did a story on Pluralsight and Aaron's entrepreneurial journey quite a few years ago. And I was impressed to see that Aaron had really very efficiently bootstrapped his company out of Utah, not Silicon Valley, out of Utah. And I think at the point where Aaron and I met, he was already doing $16 million in revenue with no outside financing. So Aaron's going to tell you a lot more about that story. Welcome, Aaron, to the show. And I am thrilled to showcase you as one of the first guests in 2015.
Thank you, Sriman. I have to thank you, actually, for doing that story. I've been waiting for this moment, actually, for a few years now to express my appreciation, because that story you did, really created almost a catalyst for us in a lot of ways. Because we were here in Utah, not too many people knew about us at the time, but we had done something very special. We had built a really strong business, and you were one of the first people to recognize what we had done. And as you wrote that story and highlighted some of those key principles, that was actually part of what helped jumpstart a lot of the awareness around Pluralsight. So thank you so much.
You're most welcome. My great pleasure. So Aaron, tell our audience a little bit about how you got Pluralsight off the ground, especially in an off-center geography and a long time ago, like Utah.
Yeah. So there are obviously some challenges to building a business in Utah, but there's also a lot of really big advantages. The cost of living here is a lot lower. There's not as much competition for the best talent. So if you can build a company that has a really great culture, where you're doing some really innovative and awesome things in tech, you can really attract the best talent without. It's more like swimming in clear ocean, clear waters, as opposed to the bloody waters where you've got so many high-tech companies competing for the same talent. So when we first started out, the company actually didn't have any offices, no physical offices at all. We were just online. My two co-founders, one of them lived in California, one of them lived in Upper Maine, and I was here in Utah. And so the first actually 7 years of the business, we didn't have any physical office space anywhere. And it was all virtual, very efficient model. And when we decided where to build the business, we actually looked at all three of those locations and a few other locations, and we kind of honed it down between, California, Utah. My co-founder was thinking about maybe leaving California at some point, and there's obviously big challenges around building businesses in California for a lot of different reasons. Also there's a lot of advantage to being right in Silicon Valley, but we chose Utah as a strategic advantage, actually. We thought it was going to be a better place to build a business, and it's proven to be so.
Now, your business is in educational technology or online education. Now, this
That's
is
right.
also not a sector that is producing a lot of very high-value companies, high-monetization companies. So tell us a little bit about what you're doing with Pluralsight, what your business is, and what is special about your business that is actually producing serious monetization.
So really what we're providing is real education that produces valuable skills that people need in their jobs, to progress in their jobs and to stay relevant in their careers and to progress in their careers. And so the kind of education we provide is really focused on professional learning, lifelong learning that really matters to people. And so, and because we focus primarily on the tech space, it makes for a great subscription-based business model because, you know, the technology is always changing. So as we've grown this business, we've seen that we've been able to build this really strong base of subscribers that stay. Retention is really strong. And then as we continue to acquire new customers, you know, the growth just continues to kind of magnify over time. And it's something that people, it's kind of the lifeblood for a lot of the professionals that we serve. And I think that's the key difference between us and a lot of the MOOCs and a lot of the other players in the space is really the focus on real skills that people need right now to really progress and have an impact on the businesses they serve.
Let me provide a bit of context for our audience here on what's happening in the education space. You know, online education has seen one major wave of MOOCs, as Aaron just mentioned. You know, this is edX and Coursera and Udacity, and these companies are bringing free lectures and free courses from various universities online. However, these also lack monetization models. So while you can build a great nonprofit, edX, by the way, is a nonprofit joint venture between Harvard and MIT, and a lot of different universities are on that platform now. But if you're trying to build a venture scale, let's say a unicorn company out of that business model, that doesn't really work. At least there's no evidence that that is going to work. However, what Pluralsight is doing is a subscription-based educational program for technical training. So it's programming, various programming languages, various technical skills, and so forth. And it's squarely that. And it's adult education. It is, you know, people learning on the job, people learning to get jobs. And as a result, there is a direct correlation between, you know, what you're learning and how you're applying that learning to monetize your own investment in that learning. So it's very, very practical, very pragmatic. The other big important point to keep in mind of in the reason why Pluralsight is monetizing and scaling is that the people who are the consumers of this educational technology are the ones who are buying. So unlike K through 12, where it's parents buying for children and so forth, this is adult learning. And in general, this is a piece of industry analysis I want to share with you. The types of educational technology where the user and the buyer are the same, are one and the same, are scaling a lot better than the K through 12 type of stuff where the dynamics of the business are very different and much more complex. So that gives you context about Pluralsight. Now, so when we met, Aaron and I met, the company was already at $16 million of profitable revenue. At that point, Aaron started employing very different growth strategies, and you employed a roll-up strategy. Now, if you read the Unicorn book, by the way, I have dealt with the roll-up strategy as one of the mechanisms and strategies of building unicorn companies. So Aaron is a textbook example of two things that we are dealing with in 1M1M as methodology. One is bootstrap first, raise money later. So $16 million of revenue with no outside financing. It's a bootstrap venture until that point. And then Aaron starts applying the roll-up strategies. Tell us more, Aaron.
Yeah, I mean, the revenue was really the thing that gave us the leverage and kind of the strength, I would say, to then, you know, be in a really strong position to raise money in a very favorable way for the company and for the founders, you know, without losing control, without giving up too much. And that was a key point for us going into that phase. And then the raising of the money actually increased our credibility in the marketplace, you know, to begin a more aggressive M&A roll-up strategy around the content that we felt would really serve our overall audience better over time. So it was kind of the sequence of events, and it all kind of, you know, built on itself over time. I don't think we would have been able to accomplish as quickly what we did without doing the financing, without raising the money, because I don't think we would have had the credibility in the marketplace to go approach some of these companies that we wanted to acquire and have them consider us as a serious, partner, with a vision big enough for them to become a part of. So there were a lot of things there psychologically that were important that played out. But I also want to emphasize that, the organic revenue has continued to grow at a very aggressive pace, at the triple digit level throughout the last, 3 years since we've started talking, Sharmana. And the M&A roll-up piece has been kind of the accelerator to dive into new content areas across the library. When we spoke first, we were just doing software developer training. It was just the programming languages, the software frameworks, those kinds of things. We didn't have any IT infrastructure related training. We didn't have any creative skills training. Those are two other big areas that we've delved into over the last year, primarily through the M&A activity we've been able to execute. And that would have taken years longer to do.
Let's double click on that a little bit. So the first
sure.
company you acquired was Train Signal, right?
Correct.
And Train Signal happens to be another company that we actually did a story on as well. And the point at which the founders of Train Signal, they were already doing $7 million in revenue, bootstrap revenue.
That's right.
That's the first company that you acquired after raising the money. So how much money did you raise?
The Series A was $27.5 million.
And to the extent that you're comfortable discussing it, how did you financial engineer the first acquisition? And the reason I bring this up is private-to-private roll-ups are excruciatingly difficult to because establishing valuation is very complicated. So was it a cash deal? Was it a stock cash mix deal? What kind of a deal did you structure with Train Signal? How did you value the company, et cetera?
So the value of the company was based on a multiple of their revenue and what we felt the future, the multiple was based on what we felt the future growth might look like. And we understood to some degree what that should be valued. We had more confidence because of what we knew our value to be after having gone through the Series A valuation phase ourselves. So understanding the business, understanding the characteristics of the content, the quality of the content, the future growth potential of the author network around that content, like we knew that business so well. Because it was so in sync with ours, it was just a really nice parallel that we felt pretty comfortable about valuation. Like we were able to think about a multiple that would be a good, a great outcome for them, and also something that would fit in well with kind of our value as a parent company. And we did in all the deals we've done, we've always taken the approach of doing a combination of cash and stock and also incentive units or stock options for the key employees that are coming over with that deal. And all three of those elements I think are really critical to make this kind of private transaction work well, because we as a company had to believe that they really believed in the future vision of what we were trying to build. And that they felt like there was a better outcome for them long term, with the Pluralsight stock they would then own at post-transaction, along with the current outcome they had at this kind of milestone of the transaction, that they would feel compelled, to do that. So balancing those things, so you really feel confident that, hey, everyone here is aligned to this North Star that we're trying to build towards, which is really this much bigger vision, this bigger valuation long term, and everyone's committed to that cause. And if you lean too far one way or the other, I think it makes it really hard to get a deal done. But if you can balance those things nicely, given the needs and the desires of everyone involved, you can construct something that's going to make it a really healthy relationship long term.
Great. So the topic of unicorn is hugely about valuation, so you're giving us a segue into that discussion, and I think that's a discussion we need to have at some level of. Can you walk us how you navigated the valuation from, like Series A? What kind of valuation were you able to get at Series A? How did that escalate after the first acquisition? When did you raise the next round, and what kind of valuation jump did you get on that? So how did you – just give us a little primer on how did you do this and what
Sure. Yeah, so the, you know, the Series A valuation was in the, you know, $100 million range. So approximately $100 million, you know, post money, just below that. And, you know, at the time, you know, based on $16 million in revenue, it felt like a healthy valuation. And that was based on, I mean, that's, if you look at trailing 12 months, that was $16 million of trailing 12 months. We were pretty confident in the next 12 months, we were going to have another year of 100% growth. And so, you know, depending on whether you're looking at forward revenue or trailing revenue, you know, or somewhere in between, you know, it was, you know, you can figure out what the multiple is. We felt like at the time, you know, it was healthy, you know, based on what else was happening in the marketplace. We also didn't want to, you know, go for such an aggressive valuation in the beginning that, you know, it would put the investors, make the investors nervous and set the bar too high for them to feel comfortable with where we were trying to go. So trying to balance all those things, it felt like a reasonable place to start. And we had a lot of competition, so we knew what people were willing to pay. You know, we balanced that process, I think, as well as we could have at that point in time. And if you look at the structure of the deal, the nature of the deal, the mechanics, you know, in the agreement, it was very favorable for us to be able to keep pivoting and keep moving quickly. That was something that was very important to us, and to make sure we would be able to maintain control of our culture. And then over the next 2 years, it was really a two-year window, because that was December of 2012, and now we did our last round, actually, and we closed in October of 2014, so actually just shy of 2 years. Our valuation went from there to, you know, the high 100s, close to a billion. Okay, we're not quite at a billion yet, but we're just shy. And you know, two things have happened. The multiple we're getting has grown, and obviously our revenue has grown dramatically. We went from 16 back then, and now we're close to 100 million in billions right now. And so, you know, if you just do the math, I mean, it's those are the two things that have occurred. And the reason the multiples have grown is because the market has changed, because we've been driving a lot of the consolidation. And just, you know, through the roll-up strategy, we're emerging as one of the dominant players in the space, and that is giving, you know, the investors a lot more confidence in our future, right? And so that produces higher multiples.
What other companies have you acquired in this roll-up strategy?
So Train Signal was one. That was the IT content play for us. That was the investment there. We also acquired two smaller online training firms that were focused on open source developer technologies, TechPub and PeepCode. Then we made our big move into the digital creative skills space when we acquired Digital Tutors early last year, February of 2014. That was a pretty big deal. That was over $40 million, that acquisition. And then just at the end of this last year, October timeframe again, we closed a deal with Smarterer, which is an online assessment platform. And that was our first non-content acquisition, where we're focusing a lot more on extending the capabilities of our learning experience and overall learning platform. And we believe that's a key piece. If you want to dive into that, I'm happy to share more details there. But that was our biggest acquisition today. That one cost $75 million, combination of cash, stock, and incentives. And
what are they doing?
Sorry, I didn't hear the first part.
How much revenue were they doing?
Smarter?
Yeah.
Yeah, we did not disclose that, but not much. So this was largely an IP focused acquisition. What Smarterer has built is basically an assessment algorithm and engine through which we can assess any skill set in a matter of 2 minutes or 10 questions. So, for example, if you said you knew JavaScript, I could give you one of these assessments, and in about 10 questions, I would be able to give you a score that feels a lot like an SAT score on a scale of 0 to 800 that places you in the overall, you know, on a scale of 1 to, you know, however many JavaScript developers there are in the world, we'll be able to give you a feel for where you sit in the overall marketplace of JavaScript developers. And it's very fast, very efficient. So when you think about using that at enterprise scale within an organization for workforce planning and just for an individual to figure out what my gaps are, it's really, really compelling. We believe assessments are going to drive our future learning experience. So people will come in and actually assess their skills, and then the assessments are going to tell them, here's the dynamic learning path that's customized for you. Here's how you go fill in the gaps and become a more, you know, advanced or experienced, you know, a master JavaScript developer. So that's why that one was so key for us. And there's one other acquisition we haven't announced yet that we will announce in about 2 weeks.
Okay. And what is the money that you raised to support this many acquisitions?
So there was that Series A round, 27.5, and then we closed our Series B round this last year, also in October timeframe, which was actually no, that was actually September timeframe, I think, and that was $135 million in financing. And so that's the total amount we've raised to date. We've also used, you know, got some banks involved. We've been very creative in exercising our debt muscles and, you know, balancing out, you know, how we think about using the cash on the balance sheet versus the debt capacity we have as a company. And I mean, as you know, we've always had very strong profit margins. Back when we spoke, I think I was pretty clear about that. I mean, our EBITDA has always been very, very strong. We've always been profitable and still are today. So that gives us a lot of strength to use a lot of, use our financial resources in a very creative way.
So that actually brings up a very important point and something else you said earlier about not being too aggressive about the valuation is also an important point to keep in mind, because I am kind of concerned about what's happening in the late stage private capital raising market. You know, we have these highly overvalued companies with very questionable unit economics. You know, you're spending so much money to acquire customers, and the lifetime value of customers just do not justify that kind of customer acquisition spending. And that is creating terrible P&L structures. And then you take that out into the public market, and there is absolutely no way in hell that the valuation is going to sustain. A great example of that, which is a story that's on our blog today, actually, is Box. Box has terrible financial metrics. If you look at the P&L of that company, if you look at the fundraising, if you look at the valuations, it's a completely unstable, unsustainable deal. So I'm actually very happy to hear that you're, you know, being diligent and financially sound in respect to both valuation as well as profitability. Do you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, we've always felt that our strength and the almost the backbone of the company has been the financial results, right? The fact that we've been able to grow the top line as quickly as we have while maintaining really strong EBITDA margins. And the funny thing is, you know, our investors actually get nervous sometimes because our EBITDA margins are so healthy, you know, because they see that money sitting there, right? And they think, well, what if we spent that? What if we were being more aggressive? How much more could we drive the top line? And that's actually always kind of a conversation we're having with them, because, you know, investors tend to push companies more that way. They want to see every dollar that they've invested being used and being used aggressively to drive that top line, because ultimately the top line is what and the growth of that top line is what matters, I would say, most in terms of typical valuations. But, you know, the strength of the EBITDA and the bottom line is what really gives you security and the ability to experiment, to pivot, you know, to have control of your own destiny long term. And so, like, it is a balance. Like, you can't go too far one way or the other, but we feel like maintaining a healthy EBITDA margin is a real key part of how we function as a company.
Yeah. Well, I think if your desire is to long term be a publicly traded company, you're better off balancing growth and profitability both, as opposed to just focusing on growth and driving your burn rate to a point where you become reliant on outside capital on a continuous basis. It's not like companies have been built with that strategy, but I think the public market gets a lot more nervous about that strategy versus if you have a healthy P&L that they can work.
Yeah, that's how we feel.
We're nearing the end of the segment, but I want to ask you for a synthesis of what your advice to our entrepreneur audience is.
Oh, boy. So many things that it's always hard to distill all the lessons we've learned down into anything succinct. But I would say one of the most important things is to, when you start building a business, to have just a laser focus on what you really are passionate about and what the problem you're trying to solve. Have your purpose really clearly in your mind, and that's just solid. And for us, that was always democratizing professional learning. Like, that's been our North Star. Like, we want to take the kinds of corporate professional training opportunities that have only been available to the elite, to people with money in first world countries, and we want to make that available to the world. And that drive has been the thing that's, you know, carried us forward and through a lot of really hard decisions and tricky things. It's kind of the thing that always becomes your true north. And so I think being really clear about your purpose and then making sure that as you start to get into aggressive growth, that you're also really focused on the culture you're building within your company, because that becomes the fabric for all future growth. And once you're past kind of that initial bootstrapping phase of just getting the company off the ground, getting a product to the market at once, and you're generating revenue, then, like, looking around here in this office, how do you then build something that's going to go beyond just you? Right? And that's kind of the phase we've been in the last little while, the last probably 2 years, year and a half at least, that has been incredibly important for us. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs don't stop long enough to think about culture. And if you don't think about it, it'll get away from you. So those would be my two lessons, at least for today, is my know what your purpose is and obsess about your culture.
And how long did you operate in the bootstrap mode before hitting the stride for that hypergrowth phase?
So it was nearly 8 to 9 years, depending on when you count the start date. So when you met me, I mean, December, when we raised, I think you did the interview with us in like September of 12 or something like that. And we raised our first round, I think, December of 12. And that we started the company back in June or July of 2004. That was when we officially signed the paperwork. So that was 8.5 years.
Bottom line, it's a marathon, not a sprint.
That's right. And we actually feel right now like we're just now solidifying our base for the next 10 years. I mean, that's really how we look at it. And it's a healthy way, I think, to think about building a business.
Yeah, and I think if you, as you said, you have a true north. If you have a true north, if you have a vision for what you're trying to build and you're committed to that vision, it's actually quite okay and comfortable to build something over a very long time. I think most founders who have built significant companies that have really made big impacts on their industries have done one thing, and they've done it over 10, 20, 30 years.
Yeah. So, I see a lot of entrepreneurs, take money too soon. You know, like where they'll give up massive amounts of equity, for a little bit of money. And I look at that now, like with my perspective, and scratch my head, because if there's any way you can get through those periods of time without doing that, like, it will be a healthy experience. Right. And it's a refiner's fire.
That's totally the philosophy that we practice in 1M. 1M is bootstrap first and raise money later. Well, thank you, Aaron, for being with us. Good luck. You have a long way
to go,
even though you've come a very long way. Congratulations and all the best.
Thank you, Sharmana. Thank you so much.